Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Hi, and welcome to our latest Book Reporter Talks To interview. Today, I'm going to be interviewing Karen White, which I am so looking forward to. We've had so many conversations on the phone about your books, but we haven't met in person. And we're going to be talking about the latest book in her Trad Street series. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to be talking about the upcoming books that she does in her series with Beatrice Williams and Lauren Willig. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be a multifaceted interview.
Yes, excellent.
So welcome, Karen. Let's start with you telling us about the Trad Street series, because okay. I want to just hear more about where you came up with these books.
Well, depending on who the audience is, so if you're around my age, you will get this reference. I call my Trad Street series, well, some people call them Nancy Drew for adults. I call them, they're my Sixth Sense meets National Treasure meets Moonlighting. Remember the Moonlighting series back in the... If you're younger than I am, then probably Castle would be, you know, it's that sort of repartee between the detective and the... So the main character is an OCD realtor who in Charleston, South Carolina, who sees dead people and can communicate with them. But that's why she makes a living from selling these beautiful historic homes in Charleston, but she hates old houses because they always have a dead spirit who wants her help.
Right.
And so when they start talking to her, the way she sort of tries to block them out is she starts singing ABBA songs.
So so she doesn't have to hear what they're doing.
Exactly. So that's, she's really grown and changed since the first book, which is fun, but she's, some people get annoyed with her, but you have to understand her background, you know, where she's coming from, why she is the way she is. And I think that makes her even more charming because she has overcome a lot, and that's how she's overcome it, by being a little weird.
A little bit different. This is the first book that I've read, but I figured that since it was the Christmas spirit,
yes.
the Trad Street,
mm-hmm.
I could read it because it's a Christmas book.
Right.
You can read out of order, I felt.
Right.
But it was interesting because as I was reading it, I was picking up all the little, like, I don't know everything about Melanie, but I was picking up all these little details. How hard is it to write all those little kernels? So if you're picking up book six,
right.
you aren't lost.
Right. Well, you know, I've been with Melanie since I started writing the first book in 2005.
Wow.
So we're like sisters now. And a lot of people, and I'm not saying, neither confirming nor denying, but some people who read these books say that Melanie is me, but again, there may be some traits that we share.
There are two little dogs running around.
Yeah.
They're adorable.
Hominies.
When I talked to Karen on the phone, they're running around in her house too. Yeah, so I think I get the dogs.
Yeah.
yeah.
And you know, I am familiar with a labeling gun, but I don't use it obsessively like Melanie does. I don't organize, I haven't labeled the drawers. I've wanted to, you know, where you put the socks and stuff like that, but not yet.
But you have a lot of writing to do, so
yeah,
that's
exactly,
the only thing that's keeping
exactly.
you from labeling.
But because I know her so well, she's, you know, it's like describing your sister. You mm-hmm. know, you've been with her so long, you know her little funny, you know,
little things to drop in. Mm-hmm. Little things to drop in. Mm-hmm. So it was okay I started with the Christmas book, but you really recommended to me reading the rest in order.
I really do.
You can see the evolution of Melanie.
Because, mm-hmm. and I try to really, a lot of people who, readers will email me and say, oh, I don't, you know, I'm not a ghost book kind of person or thriller person or scary book person, but I picked up your book because my sister-in-law, whoever told me to read it, I love this book.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, the secondary plot lines are always about, you know, there's a ghost, there's that mystery trying to be solved, but these are still character-driven books.
Yes,
it's Melanie, it's the growing cast of characters, and to see them in the first book, see her especially in the first book, see her grow and change and evolve, and this growing cast of characters kind of glom onto her life. That, I think, and my readers tend to agree, that is the joy of the series.
Right.
The rest of it is just icing on the cake. So,
I just love that she's seeing these dead people in the room. So she walks in a room and she's seeing a crowd.
Right.
And everybody else is just seeing one person
right.
in the room. And she's
right.
like, oh, all these people.
Right.
I don't want to go to sleep.
Dancing
I don't want to be able to have to see what's going on. So when the first book came out in 2008, you started writing in 2005, came out in 2008, did you immediately see the whole arc of the story? Did you know where everything was going to go?
No, and it's really funny because people always say, well, where did this idea come from? And I was taking a shower and the character of Melanie Middleton knocked me upside the head. So I knew it was going to be a beautiful southern city, whatever, and I kind of knew the story. But when I first sold it, because I was writing, you know, I had one book a year. I was doing fine with one book a year. And this character hit me upside the head. I knew she saw dead people. I, you know, didn't really know much more about it because I'm not a plotter. And I wrote like the first three chapters and I sent it to my agent. She's like, this is very different, but I love it. Mm-hmm. You know, let me send it to your editor at Penguin. And luckily Cindy said, love it. But, I think they were a little scared. They even wanted me to use a different name because they didn't think the readers of my existing books would want these books, not realizing that these are still Southern women's fiction
books.
They
are, totally.
They only wanted me to do two books.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I literally was in the middle of writing the second one when the first one came out. And, you know, my agent called and said, oh, they want two more. And, or was it three more? They wanted more. And every time, so I had to, like, redo that book so I could, and so every time I get to the end, we want more. Like, okay, so I have to make up stuff. So I just started writing like epilogues in all the books, like where it could be a leaping off place.
Go where we could go from there, just in case you had to keep going.
Yeah.
Because they didn't come out in consecutive years.
No,
Like, let's see, it was like 9, 11, 14, 17. So in between, you're writing
all
the standalones.
And I don't even know when the seventh one's coming out.
Right.
So, but because, yeah, with the publishing schedule and, you know, just trying to fit it in. Because remember, it's not just the publication, it's the writing time and what else is going on.
Right.
So that it just worked that way. And I really hate it when people discover this series, you know, or when I discover a series on the first book. But see, now if you're jumping in, you're on book six already.
I know, but I will go back.
Okay.
Because I thought it was fun, and Charleston was such a terrific setting.
Yes.
And you really brought the city to light in a very different way, because I felt like, okay, so in this one, they're going to be doing this progressive dinner on this tour, which I've always wanted to do a progressive dinner. Now I'm not so sure anymore. But they're doing this progressive dinner, and it's going to be at her house, which she's really not that charmed about having at her house. And she's doing
for various reasons.
For various reasons. Like, who else could show up?
Exactly.
All the historical bodies that could be showing up at dinner, extra count on the food, but or non-food. Mm. But as I was reading it, though, I felt like I was falling in love more and more with Charleston.
Yeah.
And I found myself going out and Googling all these different places in Charleston, because there are streets that you're actually mentioning. In fact, in the week that we're going to air this interview, you actually have a Trad Street weekend in Charleston. So tell us, what's that?
The second time we did it, the first time we did it was with this book, when this book came out, which was January of 2017, I believe.
Yeah.
And this amazing bookseller in Charleston, Polly Buxton of Buxton Bookstore, and my publicist and I sort of thought, oh, everybody wants to go to Charleston because it's an amazing, I've always had an affinity for it. I only found out recently that I actually had ancestors that lived on Trad Street and Broad Street. And
really?
Yes.
Oh, how fun.
I know, which is very
spooky.
Whoa,
whoa, whoa,
whoa, I know, right? And so we just thought, because Charleston is such a destination.
Right.
And these books are so quintessential Charleston, that it just seemed like a good idea. Why don't we have, you know, some authors go on a cruise.
Right.
Instead, why don't I have my readers come to me and we'll, like, you know, have these, you know, Charleston food events, ghost tours,
but
regular
I see
tours.
That I was looking at the agenda and there are four different ghost tours. So are you on all the ghost tours?
No,
or
think,
what's going on the ghost tours?
I think I'm just going on one of them. But one of the funny, it's a special treat for people who are going to the weekend is, so I don't know if you remember the character Megan Black in these.
Yes.
So, you know, my daughter is Megan White.
Gee, went really deep for different names. Okay.
So that's basically my daughter. She's a caricature of herself. She's the one doing the excavation of the cistern in the back, wearing her pearls and her J. Crew sweater.
And that would be your daughter.
That would be my daughter. Yeah. So she's going to be at the Trad Street weekend as a guest appearance.
A guest appearance, Megan White for Megan Black.
Get it,
you know, I totally get it. So one thing I will also notice is there's lots of decorating in these books. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of decorating that goes on. I felt like I could see all the houses. Mm-hmm. You love doing this? Do you love decorating?
It's
or do you love writing?
I'm just, I love these beautiful old houses. Yeah. And I love the way that they've been restored and put together. My daughter has a master's in historic preservation, and she actually has been a docent at mm-hmm. more than one of the historic homes.
Right.
We've done historic home tours. And I just notice that the details. I notice, mm-hmm. and that's why I'm just such a, I'm an old house hugger.
But you know, when I was reading, I felt like I was there. Mm-hmm. I really felt your description of place as well as character was so terrifically strong, and I enjoyed it so much because I felt like as I was reading, I was completely caught up in all the details on the home. I felt mm-hmm. like I could see the filials. I
right.
could see whatever.
Good,
and it made it. It really made it feel special.
Good,
it did.
Good.
And I think that's...
And I do. I surround myself with... there are some gorgeous coffee table books of Charleston interiors.
Oh, okay.
And I pick a house and I'm like, yeah, this is what I think this room looks like. And yeah. And it was really fun because Christmas and... Charleston's beautiful any time of the year, but at Christmas is really special, so I really had fun decorating the house for Christmas.
Oh, yeah, you were definitely into decorating. In fact, that's what I was writing down, because all the decorations that were being of their, you know, being put up, and including that the oranges are going to be decorated with cloves.
Yes.
Okay, and I forgot it's called something special.
I don't ask me. Yeah, because I actually got the recipe from a revolutionary Charleston during the Revolution, kind of whatever, and what they might have decorated their mantles and stuff with.
Well, if I didn't have just one orange at home, I was going to bring oranges and cloves today, so you could teach me how to do this with your ruler,
right.
Because of course she's OCD, yes. And the cloves go in at exactly the right places,
yeah.
And stuff like that. Yeah. So I was...
She's so much fun to write, let me tell you.
I bet. But I also did love that she wanted to do the garland on the staircases in plastic,
yes.
Because the other stuff dies,
yes.
And it would become like...
I totally get that.
Okay, so in your life... Are you original evergreens? Or are you using the...
I'm 50-50.
Okay.
Because I'm not going to torture myself.
Right.
But I also love the real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we do 50-50. And my children, when I went to an artificial Christmas tree...
Yeah, we did.
My children didn't forgive me. So finally, the last 3 or 4 years, we've gone... We go, we pick the Christmas, and it's, you know, a bazillion dollars, and then you're watering it, and the dogs are like, you know.
Peeing on it.
It's
not good.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, but also I think that, like, the leaves start, the needles start falling on the tree.
Oh, my gosh.
The year we went out and cut a tree for the first time, we went out and we cut the tree, we came home, and I swear if I looked at the tree, the needles fell off. And I was like, wait a second, this is supposed to be so special, that it's supposed to be so good. We must have gotten the runt of the liver,
because
it just kept... Everything kept falling off my tree.
You have to water it like multiple times a day in the beginning, the first 2 weeks.
Well, we started going to the Outer Banks for Christmas for a whole spate there.
Yeah.
And we would just carry the artificial tree in the car because it was like, you know, so much easier. Yes, but I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Actually, last year I got an idea, which in the north is not a great idea, of doing magnolia leaves in a decoration outside.
Oh, we do that at home.
But try to find magnolia leaves in New Jersey in November. So I was there because there's a hotel up the street that had this decoration. I thought it looked fabulous, these big.
You'd spray paint them gold too. It's very
gold?
Pretty.
Gold? Okay, mm-hmm. I have to go do that this year. Well, if I can find them ever again. Mm. So, but they were out there till like March.
Because I have some
in
my yard.
Like, I'll just have you, we'll just have to ship them up this year because it was like crazy. So setting as well as character is important. And as you're writing, are you trying to get it all infused the same way? Or are you going back with details? Or do you, I mean, I know you have your books out in front of you in front.
I feel it. Like I look at my pictures and then I just kind of, I don't know. I just absorb it and then I just put it out there.
Go from there.
Yeah. Like, and it helps because this is... Melanie's point of view, it's first person,
mm-hmm.
you know, singular, that's it. She's the only narrator, so I'm literally seeing things through her eyes. So I see things like how she would see them and notice them, which I think helps portray the character and the characters and also the setting, all the little details and things like that, because she's seeing that and noticing it.
Right, and she's making a wry comment in her head about
mm-hmm.
it that you can actually write, which you don't have to sit there and start explaining how somebody else feels,
mm-hmm.
which I really, really liked. I definitely see a bit of you, Melanie, and you. Yeah, the little small dogs were a dead giveaway. I will just say that right now. And they're like these little nuggets. The audiobooks in the series, because I went and listened to some audio clips,
Yeah, okay. Uh-huh.
are all narrated by the same woman,
Amy Brunau.
Amy Brunau, mm-hmm. Right? Did you pick the narrator at the beginning,
I did not. And I thank goodness she has been able to do all of them, and she's also doing this one, which I'm thrilled about because I'm an avid audiobook listener because I'm driving and traveling all the time, and nothing quite throws a listener out of the story when there's a new narrator mm-hmm. for a first-person character. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, Amy is Melanie, you know, in the voice. When I first heard the first video clip from the first book, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's exactly how I picture Melanie sounding. Right. I mean, it was perfect, and I'm so glad that she's signed on to do this as well.
Yes, because I went back and listened to excerpts of all of them mm-hmm. along the way, because I just want to get it, and it's exactly the way mm-hmm. she does it. Now, here's a question. When you finish writing your books, do you read your books aloud to yourself?
Oh gosh, no.
You don't mm-hmm. read aloud to yourself? Because I've heard a lot of authors are reading aloud these days for the reason that sometimes you hear you said a word like too many times because since digital audio has become so big.
Yeah,
but I am betting because you're an audio listener.
It might just be ingrained. I might.
You probably write differently because you're used to the cadence of what you're hearing.
Yeah, because I, you know, like I'm reading it in my head, you know, and I get that.
Because if you're really listening to audiobooks, you listen completely differently than the way we read.
And absolutely.
You hear any little nuance. Mm-hmm. And if there's
any
words used too much.
Word that you use. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I've heard of authors that said that they're at readings and they're editing the book. At the podium. It's like, I think it would sound better if we weren't do this.
Oh, that's hilarious. Yeah, I get it.
So we've got six. Is there a seventh book coming?
Of course. You saw how the book ended.
Yes.
Okay.
Cliffhanger. That's all you're saying, cliffhanger.
That's all we can say. But yes, there will definitely be.
Okay, good.
I'm going to get Rotten Tomatoes thrown at me at book signings.
Well, the people at your publisher were like, wait till you get to the cliffhanger. And I was like, okay, I guess I have to start reading faster. And they were like, yeah, I wrote back. And I was like, yes, you're right. Great cliffhanger. Really, really good. Is that the last or you don't know?
It's supposedly the last. So what I will probably do is do an epilogue just in case. But, you know, now that some of the secondary characters are older and they have some of their own mm-hmm. lives or whatever, I can kind of see, you know? I mean, maybe Nola takes over her grandparents' antique store, you know? Right. And I don't know. Let's see, you know, and the little twins, one of them might have the gift.
It might be seeing, you know. But I think it's funny when you walk in a room and you see many more people than are actually in the room. That has got to be so terrifying. And who are these people?
Right.
And then realizing certain things that are going on in these homes.
Right.
I think it's
And no, true. I'm not psychic. I don't see dead people.
But you don't.
I don't know. I want to.
But I have to tell you, I am not somebody who really loves Supernatural. Mm-hmm. I don't like ghosts. Mm-hmm. But I still completely understood the story.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you have a love of history as
Of course.
And it... Looking like the historical, what's in the backyard? I mean, living in this city, it's got to be completely different because you don't know what was in the backyard.
Right, right.
And you're dropping in all these clues, but it's clear you loved history and you like writing about it in a very fluid way instead of a very scholarly kind of a thing.
Right.
Even though a lot of what they're doing is scholarly to try to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. And this book, of course, the mystery harkens back to the Revolution, mm-hmm. and a lot of people don't think. Charleston Revolution. The Siege of Charleston. It was a big deal, and patriots were. I had my ancestors in Charleston. One was a patriot and one was a Tory. Interesting. Same Civil War. Same thing. You know, two sides.
Two sides.
Just like my family can never make up their minds. So I loved, you know, because I think it's cool when people, you learn something when you read a novel, you know?
It is.
And so delving
into... much better than history, dry history books.
Exactly. So, you know, delving into the Revolution in Charleston, it was really fun, and that was a real treat. And now you also know how people during the Revolution decorated their mantles in Charleston.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, because we were going to be period correct. We're going to do all these period
Because her best friend, you know, when Melanie in the first book inherits her house on Trad Street, she looks at it and thinks like, oh my gosh, there's so much that needs to be done with it. It would be better, this lot would be better served as a parking lot, which of course you can't do in downtown Charleston. But her best friend is a professor of historic preservation at the College of Charleston, Sophie Wallen, is in this book as well. And they're so opposite, but... you know, Sophie's always, you know, wants everything to be, you know, the old way. Like, you know, when Melanie wants to paint a wall. So he's like, I'll send you the recipe to boil chestnuts and whatever to get the right. And Melanie's like, no, I'm just going to the Sherwin-Williams.
Let's match this color. Yes, let's match what's going on. But you think about what you can do now with matching color mm-hmm. that you never used to be able to do. And you can go in and say, hi, I have this little swatch of thread.
Right.
Can you please make me paint?
Or this little chip that fell off my door.
Yeah. Right, right.
It's incredible. Yes.
Like in our office where they're going to be touching up after what they painted. Yeah. Or putting in the sprinklers. Good luck. I don't think it's going to work. Besides this, you've written 19 standalones. 19?
Something like that, yeah.
Something, mm-hmm, 19 standalones. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is there a little bit of freedom in writing a standalone after writing a series book? Or is there like, oh dear, sitting down on the page, there's no guidebook?
Yeah, it's writing standalones are very difficult. They've always been hard. They don't get any easier. The thing that I love writing the series, I call them my palate cleansers.
Okay.
Because even though there's some serious stuff going on in them, there's so much humor, you mm-hmm. know, and I put a little bit of humor in all my books, but my standalones are much more serious and, you know, darker toned. And writing Jack and Melanie, you know, and the banter and just some of the stuff is, I mean, I hope
you
I'm
find
not
yourself
very,
laughing.
Yeah, I
you find yourself
up.
Laughing. I have a funny feeling you're laughing and you're like, ha ha ha.
It's a real palate cleanser. I find it really refreshing. And like, I know the book, so I'm finishing up one book, a book that comes out in 2021, a standalone. And as soon as I finish these edits, the next book I have to write is book 7 in the series. I look forward to it because it is like, you know how you visit your family once a summer?
Right.
That's how this is. It's like, oh, I get to see them again, you
right,
know?
And, right.
and I mean, it's still hard. I still have to come up with a plot.
But you're still thinking about, oh, I could do this in the house. I could do this here. I could do this there. That.
And I know Charleston so well. I know these characters. It's like when you start a standalone, it is a blank page.
Mm-hmm.
When I start one of these, like, it's not written, but there's, you know, I know my characters. I know Charleston. I know the house. I know, there's so, and plus, the you know, one of the mysteries that have been in the last two books will be resolved in this final book.
Okay.
So I already know, I just have to go back and read the earlier two books, so I'll know what clues I put in.
What little
so
breakcrumbs did I drop along the way for myself
to sit there and keep writing? Because I do forget. I literally have to go back and read, and I actually at one point paid someone to read all of them and do like a Trad Street Bible,
mm-hmm.
so I would know eye color, you know, car they drove, where they went to school, what are their interests, that kind of thing.
They do that on sitcoms because if you're going
you
to go through 9 seasons,
exactly.
What did they ever do? Oh, she had blonde hair back here. Reference that. What was going on? And it's if not, and it's called the Bible, and it's so you have everything that's going on because there are all those little details, and the readers will pick up on it.
Oh my
be this
gosh!
Crazy
yes,
thing.
They do. Yes,
and if
they
it's
do.
Not right, it won't be. You know. It won't be the same.
Mm-hmm.
So you were first published in 2000,
right.
Which was, you know, almost 20 years at this point. Have you been writing?
Oh my gosh.
I know. What's changing your writing at this time besides I'm sure you have more confidence in your writing?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Really?
And I really, when I go back and read my other books, I do realize my writing has become tighter mm-hmm. and cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think each book is better than the last. But when I had the opportunity 9 years after my first book was published to republish it. So they let me go back and clean it up and whatever. And I realized that, you know, this was a pretty good book. The story is really cool. But the writing, you know, definitely needed to be cleaned up. It wasn't awful, but it was not to the caliber, I think, that I write now, which is nice. But I still approach every book the same way I approached writing that book. I don't think about what came before or what might come next or how it might be received or who might read it or like it or whatever. I just write a book that excites me
mm-hmm.
and it's the kind of book I'd want to read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I want characters I can care about that are flawed, that some, you know, are they redeemable? Maybe, you know, that they're very close to not being redeemable. But I need them to be understood, you know, from where they've been. And I like those complex characters. And I think my characters have gotten more complex mm-hmm. as I've gone along. And I think that makes them a more interesting read because the reader doesn't always know what choice they're going to make. And it's my job to make sure that the reader understands what that choice, you know, why they
whether it's a good choice or bad, like
exactly,
why they went
and
did
why
it.
They're doing it. And mm-hmm. So even like when I start this next book or when I start my next standalone, It's always with, I just clear my head and I just try to focus on that one story. Because you can't like, oh, where am I going to hit on the New York Times? I can't go there because it drives, there's the things you can control and the things you can't.
Right.
And I can't focus on things I can't control because it's, I use this in, I can't remember which book I use it in, you know, worrying about things you can't control is a lot like sitting in a rocking chair, you know, keeps you busy, but it doesn't get you anywhere.
Ah, good line. Very good line. And you know what it is? Because so many times a book will not hit the New York Times list because of the time of year it came out.
Right.
Or whatever.
No, a million reasons.
A million different things
but
can
it
happen.
But it still sells well.
But it sells really, really well, and you build readership.
Right.
And I think there are other benchmarks. I think that I think that authors need to look more at how fans are receiving their books. And what they're saying. And I know when I was reading this, I was completely swept up in the story. And I read a lot. I mean, I read a lot.
Right.
So for me to be sitting there saying, I'm coming in on book six here, but I am so interested in these characters and the place, and I want to book a trip to Charleston. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I can't be the weekend that you're going. Yeah. I know I'm doing a different festival that weekend. Mm-hmm. But it was just really nice to be able to sit there and say, I'm so caught up in this story, even though I'm coming in so late. And the characters were so robustly drawn. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I think that people are not doing that. They're just not, it's like, you know,
they're paper dolls being moved. Yeah.
And the buildings also are really something that are, it's not something that's going to stand out. Now, granted, you're dealing with something historic. But by the same token, I felt, got a real feel for the town, for sitting, or the city, for sitting there looking
and
at it.
And I know this house, you know, very well. I've lived in it, you know, for since 2005, yeah.
Wow. So this is an actual home that you have gone down to?
The outside of the house is, and the inside is borrowed from other houses.
Okay.
So my fictional house, I see it in my head. You know, it's like
you like houses. You love old houses, but you love houses.
Have you noticed that all of my books, the center point is an old house?
Yes. Yes. And you live in an old house?
No.
No, it's like, it's the dream. No, but you don't want to have to do all those repairs. I mean, copper pipes.
I know.
Copper pipes.
My husband hates old houses, and I can't use it's a bad word, but you know, whenever I said, I'm like, oh, look at that house, it's for sale. Like, I'll send him Charleston real estate. He's like, he always says the same thing, and I actually have Melanie use it in the first book because she hates old houses.
Right.
You know, she grows on her. But you know, it's a beep to heat. You know,
and
so I have her actually saying that. So
yeah, that's the kind of stuff that happens along the way with those old houses. Did you live in Charleston at any point, or did you just visit?
Never.
Okay.
Never. Yeah.
At some point, though,
and the first time I visited, I was like, "Oh, I felt like I was home." It was really weird.
That's well, there's something in that background.
I know,
like, you see those people hanging around the room.
I'm telling you.
So in addition to writing the solo books and also writing the series, there wasn't enough
in my spare
for you
time.
To do. In your spare time, you started to write with Beatrice Williams and Lauren Willig, and you now have your third book. Let's move this one out for a second. Coming out in January.
Yes, okay? January 14th.
It's January 14th. And we also have, most recently, The Glass Ocean. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to drop the sound for
that
it.
That came out last year.
This came out last year. And beautiful cover. Mm-hmm. Like, we really love this. Mm-hmm. So the three of you have written three books now at this point. You call yourselves Team W.
Right.
And you travel with the Unibrain.
The Unibrain.
Unibrain, as you write. And the Unibrain is because the three of you will get an idea and incubate it together?
It's crazy. It's crazy the way we finish each other's sentences. It is absolutely crazy. It's, you know, three bodies, one brain. We're always on the same track. It's frightening. But it's a real rush creatively to get together with these two other women and just create something amazing.
And three books. You're three books in at this point, so it's not just a hobby. It's actually become something that people are looking for.
Right.
So how did it start? Were you like just sitting there saying, hey, would this be fun to not write alone?
This is funny, but this is true. You know, three authors walked into a bar.
I love it.
Yeah. And we basically, bottom line, we wanted a way to have a publisher sponsor a girls' trip.
Mm-hmm.
So
book tour is the girls' trip. Book tours, the girls' trip, and the plotting trip. You always have these big meetings.
Work.
Drink. But work.
It is a lot of work.
Because you're starting from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
There's no continuing characters. Mm-hmm. There's no whatever. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed the three of you. When was it?
Yes, for Book Club Girl.
For Book Club Girl, I think I got one word in edgewise.
Sorry, I know.
because they were chatting so much. Mm-hmm. But how do you handle a project? Like you go away and come up with the idea and nurture the idea?
We do it individually. We do not outline our books. These books you have to outline. Mm-hmm. And then we each pick a character in that time period. And then we sit down and we outline together. So we own each character and each story arc. So that that's why it's so fluid. I think that's why it's so seamless, because we own all the characters, regardless of which one we choose to write.
And they each choose to write, and it's three different time periods. Mm-hmm. And this book, can you tell us a little bit about this? Because I confess I have not read yet.
I'm in love with this book. And what's really cool is that one of the characters is actually going to be in my 2021 single title.
Oh, how fun.
So, which was really kind of fun. So, the heiress, the resistance fighter, and the widow. And so we have World War I, World War II, and 1960s, all centered around Paris, France, and all centered around an ancient talisman and a mystery that drags all three time periods together and all three story arcs together. These three amazing women, all very different. But, oh my gosh, I'm in love with this book. And I can say that because I only wrote a third of it, and I can't tell you which one I wrote.
But. Yes, and you never tell. They never tell who was writing which character. And you really, I've tried to figure out the last time, but you drop little red herrings in.
Right, so but our editors don't get it right either.
They don't get it right either, so they don't have to feel badly. What's also interesting is you pick these three different time periods. You're all writing together. And you all write differently.
Yeah.
But yet, when you write these books, it is completely fluid.
It's very harmonious. And you know, Beatrice had an interesting idea why that was. We all love music. Like Lauren and I sing. Beatrice is, I play piano. Beatrice is really into opera. And I think maybe just because we're used to harmonizing and listening to, how different voices have to sort of. Yeah. Blend together. Mm-hmm. And when we write round robin. So when, when I get it, I read the last two chapters from my two, writing partners. And then I start with mine. So it just kind of flows from what they've already laid down. So I think that's why we do. I mean, everybody says it's seamless. You cannot tell that a different author wrote one part versus the other part.
And the two books that I've read, I could not tell at all that, Forgotten Room and this, I could not tell at all that there was something different. I'm really looking forward to reading this.
Yeah, I think you'll really enjoy it.
I was on chapter like two, and I was like, I'm never going to get this done, so I don't know if I've gotten something you wrote or not.
Okay. So,
can't tell me. And that's really the fun part is, the other thing I really love is that there's a lot of competition amongst people. Mm-hmm. And we're talking to the three of you, you are really about empowering each other.
Absolutely.
And I love that.
And I do realize that's something very special. I don't know if there's any other authors I could write with. We got a question recently where online, so what do you do when somebody really hates your sentence? It's like, well, you know what? We trust each other to write the best that we can. So we don't edit each other. Mm-hmm. There's been a couple of times when one of us had said, I think there needs to be more here. And I'll tell you right now, Lauren was telling me, because it was a really important chapter, and this was under a high stress time in my life, when my brain was not firing, and they understood, they knew, and I knew something was missing. And, sometimes you just need somebody to say, she knew that it wasn't her job to say, you need to do this, change that. She was just like, I just think there needs to be more. Mm-hmm. And that's all she needed to say. And I'm like, yeah, you're obviously right. I knew exactly what had to be done.
Right.
So that kind of thing, because this is our book. That's not your part. It's not that at all. So, it's just, and we joke, we have no conflict. We agree on everything.
They do. They're joking. Okay, we agree on everything. It's all going to be.
It's sad. It's sad. Yeah.
But I think it's a very big story for young women. Mm-hmm. I think because a lot of times people just see competitors.
Oh, no, I 100% agree.
And it is also, it's usually two out of three or something like that. But every time I've heard you guys talking, it is all with that same verve and enthusiasm. But I think it also comes from the fact that the three of you on your own are all very diligent about your work. So nobody's slacking through.
I think that has a lot to do with
it. I got to pick it up.
Right, no, absolutely. And I think it's like they keep me on my A game, mm-hmm. And it's good. I see it only as a positive experience. And I do hope, I think we are, a good example to young girls, other women, that women can work together without this,
catfight.
Yeah, I think we don't really have to work very hard to do that. It's just something we appreciate this about our collaboration, and we work very hard, or we don't have to work very hard, but that is our goal, is to continue that, because that's what makes this such a joy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a joy.
And I think it definitely comes across, because there's an enthusiasm when you all go out and talk about the books. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are complaining about what their careers are like. And from every one of the three of you, I don't get that. And I think it's also because you have somebody that you're constantly able to chat with.
Absolutely.
About the business.
Absolutely.
As a collaborators. Absolutely. Besides just as competitors. Because so many people just see each other as competitors. You even have a writing group that you work with on your other books.
Yes,
and
yes.
And you collaborate with each other and go through stories. And I think that it's when you have people that you trust like that, it makes a big impact, because it can make your craft better.
Right. No, absolutely. And that's what I tell my agent. She's like, you don't have to be doing these. And I'm like, but yeah, I do.
I think it just brings some kind of, look, writing is lonely. Right. Sitting in a room, when I wrote the newsletter on Thursday night, it's completely lonely and you're constantly making stuff up. But here you're, oh, wait, this box is coming. I can just do this and I have something started.
Right. And Beatrice even said, when you're writing by yourself, you say, well, what if I do this? And this is what you hear, cricket, cricket, cricket. Mm. But when you're doing Team W, it's your text. So what if this? And then our text chains are legendary.
See, and these are the kinds of things. It's a real lesson to be learned of writing together.
Right.
Writing together, but writing differently.
Right.
Karen, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Carol. I always love chatting with you.
I love talking to you, and I love hearing about it. I think it's very interesting to have somebody who can write standalone series and then another group of books as well. My hat goes off. I know it's not easy.
Thank you.
You're
but
a real hard worker.
And I guess it keeps me sane.
It keeps you sane. And at least you don't have to go home and just be crafting around the house.
Exactly.
Or cooking or doing any of those other things because
washing the
I'm
dogs.
Writing.
Yeah.
It's exactly.
Sorry, can't cook.
Can't make dinner tonight. I'm on deadline. There you go.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks, everyone. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Keep listening for an audiobook excerpt from The Christmas Spirits on Trad Street by Karen White, narrated by Amy Bruneau, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from The Christmas Spirits on Trad Street, read by Amy Bruneau.
Smoky silhouettes of church spires stamped against the bruised skies of a Charleston morning give testament to the reason why it's called the Holy City. The steepled skyline at dawn is a familiar sight for early risers who enjoy a respite from the heat and humidity in summer, or appreciate the beauty of the sunrise through the Cooper River Bridge, or like hearing the chirps and calls of the thousands of birds and insects that populate our corner of the world. Others, like me, awaken early only to shorten the night, to quiet the secret stirrings of the restless dead who wander during the darkest hours between sunset and sunrise. I lay on my side, Jack's arm resting protectively around my waist, my own arm thrown around the soft fur of General Lee's belly. His snoring and my husband's soft breathing were the only sounds in the old house, despite its being currently inhabited by two adults, three dogs, a teenage girl, and 20-month-old twins. I never counted the myriad spirits who passed peacefully down the house's lofty corridors. Over the past several years, I'd extricated the not-so-nice ones and made my peace with the others, who were content to simply exist alongside us. That's what had awakened me. the quiet. No, that wasn't right. It was more the absence of sound, like the held breath between the pull of a trigger and the propulsion of the bullet. Being careful not to awaken Jack or General Lee, I slowly disentangled myself from the bedsheets, watching as General Lee assumed my former position next to Jack. Jack barely stirred, and I considered for a moment whether I should be insulted. I picked up my iPhone and shut off the alarm, which was set for 5 a.m. Noting it was 4:46, then crossed the room to my old-fashioned alarm clock, which I kept just in case. Jack had made me get rid of the additional two I'd once had stationed around the room. He'd accused me of trying to wake the dead each morning, as if I had to try. Since I was a little girl, the spirits of the dearly departed had been trying to talk to me, to involve me in their unfinished business. I'd found ways, most often involving singing an ABBA song, to drown out their voices with some success, but every once in a while, one voice was louder than the others. Usually because a spirit was shouting in my ear or shoving me down the stairs, making it impossible to ignore, regardless of how much I wanted to. I stumbled into my bathroom using the flashlight on my phone, silently cursing my half-sister Jane and my best friend Dr. Sophie Wallen-Arasi for being the cause of my pre-dawn ramblings. They had taken it upon themselves to get me fit and healthy after the birth of the twins, JJ, for Jack Jr., and Sarah. This involved feeding me food I wouldn't give my dog, although I'd tried and he'd turned up his nose and walked away, and forcing me to go for a run most mornings. Although I was more a jogger than a runner, the exercise required lots of energy that shouldn't be provided by powdered donuts, according to Sophie, and made me sweat more than I thought necessary, especially in the humid summer months, when bending down to tie my shoes caused perspiration to drip down my face and neck. Barely awake, I pulled on the running pants that Nola had given me for my last birthday, telling me that they had the dual purposes of being fashionable and functional, sucking everything in and making one's backside look as if it belonged to a lifelong runner. I tried to tell Jane and Sophie that these wonder pants made the actual running part unnecessary, but they'd simply stared at me without blinking before returning to their conversation regarding lowering their times for the next bridge run, scheduled for the spring. I tiptoed back into the bedroom, noticing as I pulled down the hem of my t-shirt that it was on inside out, and paused by the bed to look at my husband of less than 2 years. My chest did the little contracting thing it had been doing since I had first met best-selling true crime history author Jack Trenum. I'd thought then that he was too handsome, too charming, too opinionated, and way too annoying to be anything to me other than someone to be admired from afar, or at least kept at arm's distance. Luckily for me, he disagreed.